Yeah, thank you for the kind introduction. I'm very excited to be here. I think we are all very excited to be here. And for me, this is a bit special because the first time I attended the Congress was exactly 10 years ago, 2015, with the talk about RoHammer.js here on this stage. And that was also, I think, the largest, well, that was back then the largest conference talk I ever had. And that was very impressive.
Sure. My first conference talk or Congress talk also was here just only 1 year ago and not 10 years ago.
Yeah. And but you will also be here in 9 years, right?
Also about a similar topic about RoHammer.
So, since both were about RoHammer, let's do a short recap. RoHammer is a disturbance arrow on DRAM, so let's start with a short overview about DRAM. So we have these green chocolate bars, I would say, and this is the short time memory of your computer, and this is called the system DRAM. And then we have special channels. In these channels, we can actually parallelize the memory access, so the memory access is actually faster. And then we have the single DIMM, and on these DIMM we have we also have the other side, so the chips can be on both sides. This is called a rank. And then we have a single chip with a bank on it.
So basically, one chip holds one bank?
Well, actually, not exactly. So these chips are also split up into these banks. Well, you want to have a lot of parallelism also within the chip. So you will have a part of every bank in every chip. And then these banks are basically built from rows. You have a lot of rows, and they are each 8 kilobyte in size, and a row buffer at the bottom, but we will get to that later on. And through these rows, 8 kilobytes, so that's, 8,192 times 8 single bits that we have in there, and they have to go somewhere into this row buffer at the bottom, so we need to read the values. And this works through these bit lines or columns that we have in the DRAM. Yeah. Of course, if you think about an operating system, then this doesn't look like that. 8 kilobytes is not a size that an operating system commonly works with. There is more like 4 kilobyte pages. And on older systems, it looked something like that, where we have one page and then the next page, and those two together are one row. But today, this is a bit more complicated. Yeah.
Why is the thing called DRAM or dynamic RAM? Because it looks kind of static to me.
Well, the actual information is stored on a capacitor. And if you pay close attention in physics class, these capacitor actually lose charge over time. So these capacitors need to be refreshed regularly. And this is called a refresh rate. So we can actually keep the information that we save on the actual DRAM here. And so this refresh, that small hiccup that happens normally every 64 milliseconds, it's a bit faster for DDR5. And interesting part is then that reading some information from a RAW is a destructive process, which means we are destroying the information that is in a specific row, and to save the actual value while reading it, we have something called a row buffer.
So the values dynamically change all the time in the memory. Yep.
Okay, but what is this row buffer now?
Well, so to make that, just to illustrate a little bit better, so we have here, this is how our chip here, and we have some kind of information stored in row one. And when we would like to read from that row, we are putting that first into our row buffer here. And while doing that, we are destroying the information that is in that specific row. And then if we would like to read something else, we need to put the information back into that specific row, because we would like to keep that information here.
Okay, so basically this is how DRAM works, but I read something about Rowhammer in the title of the slides. What is this Rowhammer thing?
Well, Rowhammer, so now these cells, they can lose the charge over time, but there's also another effect that they can lose the charge if you access something nearby. And you could write a simple code snippet like this, where you just access one row and then the other row, and then you flush these rows. You have to flush them from the cache so that you actually reach the DRAM, and then you do in a very, very tight loop. And if you do that often enough, fast enough, and if you're lucky, then maybe a bit flips in the middle in a row that you might not even have access to. Because as we said in the beginning, there might be 8 kilobytes or even more in the middle that the operating system assigned to a different process, maybe even to a page table or some other kernel data structure. There are different hammering techniques. We saw single-sided hammering, which is fairly simple to mount with little information. Double-sided needs a bit more information. You need to hammer specific sandwich, specific rows, and one location, again, a bit easier with less information. Yeah. Many, many more hammering techniques and patterns have been presented over the years. Yeah, and they work on different DDR generations than, you know.
Okay, but DRAM is kind of volatile, so can't we just reboot the system and everything is fine again?
Well, it's not persistent memory, right? So it would lose all the information if you do that. Yeah.
Hmm. Can we maybe try to detect these patterns and then maybe do some black magic in order to avoid Rowhammer?
Yes, there is black magic. This is called target row refresh. This is the industry countermeasure against Rowhammer attacks. And we have two things here. We have the one thing is the sampler, and the other thing is the inhibitor. So what the sampler is doing, it just looks for the memory access and counts the memory access on specific rows. So if there is some Rowhammer attack going on, we are just counting the number of accesses. And if it reaches a certain threshold, then the sampler gives an alarm to the inhibitor. And the inhibitor actually refreshes the victim rows to avoid Rowhammer attacks. And the good thing is this implementation is in hardware, it's vendor specific, and it's proprietary, so we are safe.
But this sounds like kind of security by obscurity to me.
Yeah, and this is also something that you can break. The Blacksmith paper a few years ago actually demonstrated that you can just fuzz for patterns that work. They did this in different characteristics, and they found bit flips then on all 41 DIMMs that they tested. So it's okay. Just security by obscurity.
You are talking about these strange aggressor rows now. Mm-hmm. As far as I remember, when I write a program, I have something like virtual addresses. So how do I get from a virtual address to an aggressor row?
Yeah, that's tricky.
So reverse engineering to the rescue. So as we said before, we have different banks. And for us, it's important that we have memory addresses that are on the same bank, so we can actually hammer nearby rows. So if we take two memory addresses and they are on the same bank, then if we measure the time, and we can actually use the CPU, it's called the timestamp counter, so we get the resolution of the CPU frequency, and we can measure the time. And if that is slow, then that means these two memory addresses belong to the same bank because they share a single row buffer, because you need to put it back, and that takes a little bit longer. If we have two memory addresses that are on separate banks, that will be pretty fast because they have a separate row buffer.
So that means there is a timing difference. That's a side channel. Yes, here's a histogram. That's a side channel. We can exploit that. We can mount a text with that.
Come on. No side channel. We have no time for side channels. Now, what about these addressing functions that we need to reverse engineer?
Yeah, if we take a look at the physical address, we're working with physical addresses here. Some of these bits will be used for the row index because we have a bunch of these rows. That's basically the main dimension, how you can scale up DRAM modules, increasing the number of rows. Then there are the columns, fixed number of columns, always the same. And then there's also some offset that is already used for the cache line, so also this is already assigned. But we had these DRAM banks. How do we get to the DRAM banks? Actually, Martin, we gave this to you as a homework.
Okay,
did you look at that?
Yes, of course I looked at it. So basically, it actually works like this. We use multiple offsets of the physical address. We combine them with an XOR operation, and then we get one resulting bit. And this, in this example, is the bank bit 0. We can represent this with a bit mask by simply writing a 1 to all bits we use in our XOR combination and a 0 to all the bits we don't use. And we can represent this bit mask as a hexadecimal value, which is typically the thing done with these bank addressing functions. Of course, we don't have only one bit, because with one bit, we could only distinguish between two banks. Therefore, we need another bank bit, let's say bank bit 1. Works just the same as bank bit 0. And then we need another one, bank bit 2, for example. And what you can see right now is that it overlaps. So basically, bank bit 2 reuses some of the bits we already used for the row index. But that's actually not a problem. It's just how it's implemented. So let's assume we have a bank function number 2. We have a bank function number 3. And when we take all of them together, we have 4 bank functions. This means we have 4 bit. And this means we can address 2 to the power of 4, so 16 DRAM banks with these functions.
And you want to reverse engineer them?
Yes, we tried it at least.
The good thing is there some kind of mechanism we can be sure that these addressing functions are correct?
Yes, we actually published something at ISURIX this year. Basically, the idea is when we remove one addressing function, this means that one of the bits, let's call it, is arbitrary, and thereby basically we can only address half of the banks. So when we have 4 functions and we remove one, there are only 3 left. With 2 to the power of 3, we can address 8 banks. Our system has 16 banks, so we lose half of the banks. And this should drop the correctness score when we group addresses using these functions. And what you can see in this graph is exactly this happening. So when we remove one function, it is reduced to 50%. When we remove 2 functions, it is reduced to 25%. And when we remove 3 functions, then it's reduced to 12.5%.
And if the functions are not correct, it wouldn't follow the expected curve.
Exactly.
But okay, maybe let's get to what changed this year, because this was a recap. You already knew this probably already.
Yeah.
So there are also a couple of new things in the last year. One is the so-called column disturb error, where researchers have shown that the bit lines actually are not limited to the so-called DRAM subarray, but also go through adjacent DRAM subarrays. So basically, when we access a row in one subarray, let's say the middle one, then we enable all the bit lines that also go to the neighboring subarrays. When we just do this repeatedly, so we enable the rows simply again, we enable all the bit lines again, and thereby there are also disturbance errors in the bit lines that are way more adjacent than the rows normally used for Rowhammer, which is basically something like the next row.
Okay, that's a problem.
And we have another Rowhammer attack. So on modern GPUs, we have DDR memory as well. And if corporate ask us what is the difference between these two pictures, well, it's the same picture. So, and if we have DDR on GPU, Rowhammer should work as well, right? So yes, it works. Rowhammer works on GDDR6. The researcher found that you can actually run Rowhammer attacks on GPUs.
So should I sell my 3090?
Not yet. But the interesting part is that the eviction strategy, so you cannot just run CFFlush, what Daniel showed us before. We need some kind of specific eviction strategy, so it's a little bit more complicated. But they were able to fuck up machine learning models from an accuracy of 80% down to 0.02%, so
yeah,
it's fine. Yeah.
Not on consumer graphic cards yet, though more on server-grade hardware. But attacks only get better. More attacks.
So basically, there was also a novel publication regarding fingerprinting. So last year, we talked about the fingerprinting approach, and they fingerprinted 8 devices. Wow. This year, there is a novel publication where they did fingerprinting on 98 DIMMs, and they reached a 99.91% fingerprinting accuracy. And they were able to extract the fingerprint in less than 5 seconds.
That's very impressive. How many devices were this? 98 DIMMs. And this worked all over these 98 DIMMs and over a longer time frame as well?
Yes, they did this over extended time frame of entire 10 days.
on all these devices?
The problem is no. They tested it only on 10 out of these 98 devices. Yeah. Then they've seen that it seems to kind of work. Then they repeated the experiment with all devices over a duration of 4 weeks. But then in the middle of the 4 weeks, of course, since they didn't have enough systems, they had to switch the DIMMs. So it was kind of a little bit confusing there.
Okay, but maybe it's possible, yeah.
And we have another publication. Rowhammer now also works with ECC enabled, so we have ECC protected RAM. The researchers focused on Hynix, and they were able to confuse the TR sampler. We come to that a bit later. And they reverse engineered the ECC matrix, and with this kind of information, they can actually run patterns that result in undetectable attacks.
But wait a minute, we explained ECC attacks last year as well. Why is this novel?
It's novel because they showed us that this works also on DDR4 RAM. Mm, okay. So, yeah.
Yeah, if you take a look at the DDR standard, you sometimes also find interesting statements in there. For instance, these refreshes, they are crucial, otherwise you lose data. But in the standard, it says sometimes it's allowed to postpone refreshes. Maybe that could be a problem. Of course, then there was the post-Hammer paper, and they exploited exactly that. They figured out how they get into this state where refreshes are postponed. They hammered exactly hammered exactly as long so that this works. Then all the postponed refreshes come in, and still we have bit flips.
But that's all on DDR4, so what about DDR5?
Yeah, DDR5 is hard to hammer because there are some changes with DDR5. The first one, we have a higher refresh rate. So that means if the refresh rate is higher, we have less time to do our row hammer attack, so that's good. And also we have a new refresh command, which gives, first of all, it refreshes neighboring rows and also gives it more time to protect against Rowhammer attacks.
So we basically have a better refresh command now, which is a little bit slower. Sounds like a good mitigation. Can't we just turn this on all devices and are safe?
Yeah, the problem is this is proprietary again, and it's also optional, so And we have on-die ECC on DDR5, which means we can also protect or fix a couple of bit flips there. And the TRR sampler on DDR5 actually works in longer intervals, and interesting is that that the TR samples the memory accesses here.
So but this is all proprietary, and I was also wondering, like, what is this? What are these red dots there?
Let's say the counting sometimes does not work so precise and misses a couple of memory accesses.
So they skip some time points and do not count.
Yeah, they're just learning to count.
And of course you can exploit this then. Phoenix, the Phoenix paper exploited that, and there they then hit the attack exactly in those parts where the sampler was not active. Yeah, of course, works. Yeah, maybe let's get to the results from the study that we started here in this room last year, the Flippy RAM study.
But maybe in the beginning, let's just do a short recap. So basically, in the beginning, the users could had to agree to participate in the study. Then we collected some system information. We did reverse engineering of the DRAM addressing functions. We rarefied them with the approach we've shown before. And then we ran a couple of Rowhammer tools afterwards. In case the user accepted, we uploaded the results to our servers. So basically, in the beginning, we gave out bootable thumb drives.
Yes, here, right? Yes, we had this.
We also thought that nobody would do this.
Nobody would ever do that.
Yes. Also we said, well, we have the hash on the website. You can verify whether it's correct. How well did this work?
Basically, we had some minor problems there as well.
What was the problem?
Well, first of all, we are flashing, you and your family were not really spending Christmas. You were flashing hundreds of USB sticks, right?
No, we flashed thousands of USB sticks.
Oh, and cheap USB sticks, I guess, because we need to be cost efficient.
Yes, of course. But actually, we had a small bug in the framework. So the plan was to write a nice summary for the users. And on the first thumb drive we flashed, we just took it and booted it on a test system. It took 8 hours to run. In these 8 hours, of course, we continued to flash thumb drives. So we got 700 thumb drives in the 8 hours. Looked something like this.
They had the old hash, the others.
Yes.
New.
And then I recognized that there's a bug. So I fixed the bug. And the other thumb drives had the bug fixed. These didn't. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we had two different hashes.
So cheap USB sticks, maybe you can just briefly explain what was the issue with that.
We had the problems that there were real scratches when we connected them via the USB socket.
But hey, I know my engineering 101. We can use some tape.
Yes, it's a good idea. We also did this. But then we had the problem when we removed the tape. Then the lacquer of the USB thumb drives are sticking to the tape and not to the thumb drives anymore. So they looked like this.
So again, we can use WD-40, right? So yeah, I think we used the whole engineering flowchart in our study. So yeah.
Actually, we did this. And then we put WD-40 on them. Then we put tape on them. Then we flashed them in parallel. Then we removed the tape. Then we had some kind of strange glue residues. And then we used isopropanol to polish the thumb drives again. And in the end, it was finally working. It was way slower than we thought, but at least it worked.
Cost efficiency.
So when I understand that correctly, so this is how it started. And you flashed more and more. So this is how it's going, right?
In the end, it looked like kind of like this.
Let's talk about the results.
Yeah.
So, what are the results of this study? We will focus on this part with the reverse engineering and then running these Rohammer tools and what the outcome of these parts was. So, what about the reverse engineering? Did it work?
It didn't work so well. As you can see, in total, we collected 1,006 data sets. It didn't work on 50% of the systems. Oops. On the other systems, we sometimes had to disable it because the user selected a shorter runtime, and then we didn't want to spend all the runtime with reverse engineering. On some systems, there was no support for 1 GB huge pages, which were required by some of the tools. On some systems, the tools simply crashed. On some systems, the tool had other exit states, so basically they ran through, but there were no addressing functions that were reported, so yes, it didn't work so well, I would say.
But this points at an open challenge for the research community. In the majority of cases, we did not get correctly reverse engineered addressing functions. So that means we could significantly influence how, what the real world applicability of Rohammer is if we solve this challenge. What about the other parts, running the Rohammer tools?
So we also took a look at the success rate of different Rohammer tools. And as you can see, FlipFloyd and Rohammer test were at least were the most ones that gave us a return code of 0. And yeah.
So they didn't crash.
Exactly. That's the case. So however, we also had some crashes. For example, in these cases here, the tools required a huge page, and the OS just gave them a huge page. And then we had the address reverse engineering crash, as Martin already said before, and some other failed runs here. And then we have a small special case for blacksmiths. The address reverse engineering functions need to be compiled in blacksmiths. So this is why we had when this was broken, so the whole compile process also failed.
Okay.
So, so one of the outcomes is that many of the Rohammer tools failed because of the missing DRAM functions, as Daniel already said, and since they didn't get a 1 GB huge page. So,
But this doesn't mean that we saw bit flips with these tools. Did we see any bit flips?
Yes, of course. Actually, Rohammer.js was the tool that worked best, then followed by Blacksmith, and then followed by a couple of other tools. As you can see, there's a difference. So basically, some tools were good on DDR4 and only on DDR4, and some were good on DDR3 and only on DDR3, which is related to the patterns. So basically, when we are on DDR4, there are patterns that need to be more complex due to TRR, and on DDR3, we can use faster and more effective patterns. However, in total, we found that 126 systems or data sets were affected, which is 12.5%. And what we want to highlight is they were affected to be vulnerable to our fully automated Rohammer attacks, which...
So this basically means on 12.5% of the systems, Rohammer is weaponizable right now.
With a framework that could probably be improved.
Okay, but let's say if I want to buy a new computer, which CPM vendor should I actually choose? Is there one which is more affected?
We looked at Intel and AMD and the processors that were used by the users in the study, and we saw more bit flips with Intel processors and very, very few with AMD. And the reason for that is basically just because the tooling that is out there was more focused on Intel, especially at the time of writing, when we started the study, when we started working on this framework. There was basically no AMD Rohammer tool available, so we couldn't include any in this study. Yeah.
But we still found some bit flips on AMD. This is because one location hammering does not need the addressing function, so we still found some on AMD.
Yeah.
We also had a couple of other systems, which was really weird, because some people obviously tried to run our test system on RISC-V-based CPUs.
What the fuck?
Okay. Yeah, so basically the conclusion here is that mainly we have mainly tools for Intel, fewer for AMD. That's why we see a bias towards Intel. We expect that AMD is equally affected. I mean, it's both processors. Yeah. The problem is the DRAM, not the processor. Yeah.
So what about the DRAM generations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, only DDR3 and DDR4 were actually affected. The other were not affected. Again, we had a lot of fails because of the address function reverse engineering not really working. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and right, do we see this big difference between DDR3 and DDR4?
So on DDR4, we have the TRR, the countermeasure implemented. So, and that needs the non-uniform patterns, so the fuzzing approach. And
it takes time. Yeah.
And also for the others, we did not include the tools that, for some reason, other were not available for other DRAM generations. So, the key insight here that is for DDR3, the simple, fast patterns that Daniel already provided us works best. And for DDR4 with TRR enabled, the fuzzing, the non-uniform patterns work best. So,
So when we take a look at the DRAM renders, then we see that basically Samsung, Hynix, and also the other renders, which are resellers, are similarly affected, where Micron is affected way less. However, it should be highlighted that this might be related to research tools being focused rather on the other renders.
Because it all involves reverse engineering.
So let's clean our crystal ball and look in the future.
Yeah, I think it's not looking too well because we are getting more shitty proprietary mitigations, it says here, similar to TRR. And that basically just means, okay, it continues to be a game of, okay, let's figure out the parameters and then let's break it.
Right? So the usual security cat and mouse game, right?
I have a really crazy idea. What about the renders just publish their approaches?
This will never work.
Crazy. Yeah. Yeah. All right. We will probably in the future, as I said, attacks only get better. And we will probably see better reverse engineering of function addresses. We will probably also see more tools on different platforms, more exploits. We're all doomed. It's all lost.
Yeah. No, no, no. You're too pessimistic, Daniel. I think we also have a bright future for defenses. For example, we could improve the whole manufacturing process, right?
Yeah, going back to the 90s with the DRAM cell size, huh?
Guys, did you take a look what DRAM costs right now? Then there will be no Rowhammer because nobody can afford it anymore.
Yeah.
We could also use something like spatial isolation, so we will put our data more distributed around the memory access, so that could work.
Yeah, but this doesn't work anymore because we had some bit flips more distant, and also column disturb, as you presented earlier.
But we could change the ratio between the memory accesses and the refreshes, so that could work, right?
That's what TRR does, huh?
Didn't work so good for TRR.
But also, that's also something that we worked on, memory band-aid solution that is also in that space and might work.
And we could also use like cryptographic hash functions like CSI Rowhammer, right?
As a replacement to ECC, yeah. Just as a very brief overview, CSI Rowhammer.
Yeah, so the idea is here that we are saving cryptographic hashes for our information and put that on a separate bank there, and thereby we have strong security guarantees, and we can also check on correct bit flips by just brute forcing and check if the the checksum is correct.
And what about this memory band-aid that you mentioned?
Basically, there the idea is that we limit the memory bandwidth per process, and thereby basically just reduce the number of activations the attacker has effectively per refresh.
Yeah, okay. But this requires probably hardware changes, yeah? It also, we need a per bank limit here. Current processors don't have that. But then we also have a per process limit. And so we don't have any overhead for trusted processors, very low overhead for untrusted processors. Yeah.
So let's just shortly recap the Flippy RAM toolset. So basically, it's pretty easy to add new tools, and we also want to ask researchers to do this, because thereby it's also easy to basically use their own tools to test on additional systems, for example, computer lab rooms at universities. It is also easy to compare against other tools that are already implemented, because they can simply be activated and then there are results for both tools. And it can also help others to reproduce the results by simply uploading the ISO image, and then other people just have the same software versions and configuration.
Which brings us to the conclusion. As I said before, Rowhammer can be weaponized right now on 12.5% of systems with the tools out there that we just took from GitHub or the other repositories where they were.
We've shown that addressing functions didn't work on 50% of the systems, and we've also shown that the CPU support was not really good on everything except Intel. So we would expect that we could double this amount with better addressing function reverse engineering, and that we could probably double it again with better support for different CPUs. So we might talk about something like 50% of the system being affected.
And also, we think the defense strategy needs to change, right? So they develop just some proprietary mechanism. It gets reverse engineered. Researchers found new ways to bypass. So we need to stop this security by obscurity. So thank you. This was our conclusion, and we are happy to take some questions.
If you have questions, please line up at the microphone. Some of you have already done so. So I can start right away with a question from microphone number one, please.
Which defenses would you recommend to put into a memory controller designed from scratch today?
I would go with CSI Rowhammer. If you have the ECC chip, if you don't have the additional ECC memory for some reason, then you will have to go with something along the lines of TRR or memory band-aid.
One question, please, from microphone number two.
Why is LPDDR affected differently?
Basically, because the tools that are out there are optimized for, let's call it, the normal DDR versions. And LPDDR behaves a little bit differently due to different voltages that are applied and maybe different clock rates and so on. There are also papers that analyzed LPDDR, but we didn't include them in our toolset because the focus was on x86.
And I also think that most people were using our framework on older system, not on their working laptops, so that could also be the case that we didn't find so many bit flips there.
But the bias is certainly also influenced by researchers using their own office laptops for experiments. And then, okay, what do you have there? Market share like 90% Intel, some, at least until recently, and not LPDDR in the laptops.
Question from the internet, please.
The internet wants to know, for the ECC-specific attack, is there a chance that not all the required bits are flipped so that a failed attack would be detected as an ECC error?
Yes, it was quite important that the bit flips, I think, were identical to the ECC distance, so they needed to bit flip exactly 4 bits in a row to get undetected, and they were able to flip bits in a RSE public key and get some messages through that normally should not get through.
I also think many of the bits that flipped, even in the ECC attack, were actually detected and corrected. And only in a couple of cases, they were able to go over the threshold and thereby effectively bypass ECC.
Yeah.
I see back there, microphone 8 has a question.
Thank you for the talk. Do you think that Rowhammer attacks would also be viable on embedded devices?
Well, if the CPU is fast enough and the DRAM is in the range of affected DRAM generations, why wouldn't it be affected?
Actually, there were cases where they used something like Panda boards to analyze PUF functions on Rowhammer, and they were affected, but they were also pretty old and had some weird old DDR2 memory. So not quite sure how it is about current embedded systems, but for sure it worked in the past.
And also we have real-time operating systems, so I think it is a little bit different there, I guess.
Yeah.
So,
We still have 2 minutes or so don't be shy. Queue up. One microphone, number 4 question, please.
Would you like people to continue trying the test ISO?
In general, yes, of course. So basically, we still have the server running. There might be a follow-up version of the paper, which we could maybe put on archive at some point when we get enough data sets in order to basically increase the number of tested data sets we have in the paper right now. On the other hand, people also, of course, can just test if their systems are affected with the current tooling.
Yeah. We still have a couple of USB sticks with us, right?
Yes. Actually, if you are interested in this, you could visit us at the Wirtshaus Franz assembly afterwards and get at least a couple of thumb drives we have left.
I have a small additional question. Will you update the ISO if any of the tooling gets updated with your remarks from this presentation?
We haven't integrated AMD yet, but this would, of course, be interesting. It's on GitHub, so we will see who finds time for that first.
Thank you.
Microphone number 1, please.
Yeah, Volt randomized functions for the bank address help. So not the static function, but for every memory controller different.
Basically, this would only help partly because the addressing functions are just used to group addresses fastly in array that they are on the same bank and just basically guessing the row offsets. So what you always could do is you just take addresses, use the row hit versus row conflict side channel in order to measure which addresses are on the same bank, and then you could just access these addresses.
Yeah. So it would only slow down the attack a bit. And I really like the idea. It has been published as a paper already, though. But I like it.
Do you already have ideas for improving the flipper RAM in the wild?
Yeah, adding more tools, I guess. Adding more tools, because there have been some developments this year that have been not been, we were not able to integrate them in time. Yeah.
Microphone 1, please.
What if you used the virtual address or address space identifier to add to the function to permute within the rows so that yes, it may, is a problem if you want to share a memory page across address spaces, but it would make it so that you can't easily probe another address space.
His argument still holds. You would only slow it down by a factor of maybe a factor of 64 or maybe 32 or 128. You have to run a few more of these side channel tests, and then you got the result.
All right. Thank you. We're out of time. One big applause for the speakers, please.